This is Kindergarten Cop, and today is Friday, June 12th, 2026. I will be reading from the Pantograph today. I'm going to start out this morning with an article titled Entering into Heaven, New Icons Add Beauty, Meaning for Holy Apostles by Matiz Janik and Annie Wang. When worshippers look toward the altar at Holy Apostles Orthodox Church, Father David Gresham hopes they see more than a new piece of woodwork. They see Christ, the Virgin Mary, the saints, and a visual expression of a faith tradition that stretches back centuries. The Bloomington Parish, based in rural Bloomington near Downs in US 150, recently installed a new iconostasis, a wall of icons that separates the altar area from the nave, where the congregation gathers in an Orthodox church. For Gresham, 59, pastor of Holy Apostles, the project represents both a spiritual and historical milestone for a parish that has grown from a small group of Orthodox Christians meeting in borrowed spaces into a congregation with a more permanent home. The parish had about 45 to 50 attendees in 2016 and has grown to about 80 to 90 now. The bright side highlights uplifting moments across our community, where good news lives. This is a major, major milestone for us, Gresham said. In the Orthodox Church, we want our worship space to be beautiful and to give an ethos of prayer, and that you feel you're entering into heaven when you come into church. Gresham said the iconostasis helps worshipers understand themselves as part of a larger spiritual community. When people are looking toward the altar, they see not only what's going on in the altar with the priest serving, but also they are surrounded by the image of the saints, Gresham said. There's a sense of community, that we are connected to those who have gone before us. The icons on the iconostasis will be in place year-round, while other icons in the church change according to the liturgical season. Gresham said the seasonal icons, vestments, and altar coverings are part of the symbolism embedded in Orthodox worship. The new icons replace an older iconostasis that largely used photographic reproduction mounted on boards. The iconostasis will have two rows of icons. The upper row will contain 12 icons of saints, known as Equal to the Apostles, while the lower row will include an icon of the 12 apostles together on the left, icons of the archangels Michael and Gabriel on the deacon's doors, side doors, and the icon of the Virgin Mary and Christ on the right. The central panels will depict the Annunciation, the biblical event in which Archangel Gabriel proclaimed Christ's conception to the Virgin Mary, with Gabriel and Mary on opposite sides. At the top center is an icon of the Last Supper. Gresham said the upper row is one of the distinctive features of the new installation. The saints, known as Equal to the Apostles, received that title because of their role in spreading the gospel. On one side of the top row are six female saints known as Equal to the Apostles, and on the other are six men. I don't know of another church parish that has that as the second row, Gresham said. Sometimes it's prophets from the Old Testament, or the apostles, or something like that, but that's what we're going to have, which I think is really wonderful. In the early church, icons served as a visual means of teaching biblical stories because many congregants were illiterate, parishioner Mary Eidelman, 73, said. The iconography of the Holy Apostles Orthodox Church includes multiple scenes from Scripture, including Photini, the Samaritan who met Jesus at the well, and Jesus appearing to the Apostle Thomas after the resurrection. Parishioner Jenny Barchus, 72, said the church acquired its first icons between 2010 and 2012, when the parish was still worshiping on Hovey Avenue. However, she clarified these were not hand-painted icons, but rather photographic reproductions from Christ the Savior Orthodox Christian Church in Chicago displayed on poster boards. Bart just converted to Orthodox Christianity 25 years ago. She said she appreciated the fullness of the religion, its emphasis on the Holy Trinity, and the reciprocal nature of worship between the priest and the parishioners. "I found, as a convert, there's a lot more movement within the parish," Bart just said. "It's kind of almost like a two-way street, because our responses are right from the priest, and then we respond back. The church is home to people from a wide range of Orthodox backgrounds, such as Russian, Greek, Romanian, and Ethiopian, as well as converts," Bart just said. "It makes me think of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. When the people are gathered around," Bart just said, "our parish here is very welcoming parish." As the church has grown, so has its approach to iconography. Parishioner Mark Comedina, 72, said he felt overwhelmed when he first walked through the doors and saw the icons. Prior to this project, Comedina said he would purchase wood from Menards and cut it to its appropriate dimensions to create makeshift icon panels, a temporary solution that stood in sharp contrast to the commissioned installation. "It expresses our love we have for Christ and that the beautification of the sanctuary and the nave are important to us," Comedina said. "Having something beautiful like this brings glory to him." The new individual icons are hand-painted and written by iconographer Dmitry Skolnick of California, while the iconostasis itself was handmade by John Sanderson, a woodcarver based out of Nashville who has worked on similar projects for Orthodox churches across the country. For Sanderson, the craftsmanship is both artistic and traditional. Sanderson said the project is hand-carved, though he uses power tools such as bandsaws and table saws. "No computer-controlled machine was used to create the carving," he said. "A project of this size generally takes about 6 months," Sanderson said. Although it was not the only project in his shop during that time, he said two or three people worked on the Holy Apostles' iconostasis. "It's very special to put it up and then have members of the parish come in," Sanderson said. "A lot of times they're emotional, so it's pretty special to see that." While each project allows for some design decisions, Sanderson said, "An iconostasis is not the kind of work where a craftsman tries to impose a purely personal style. The components are rooted in Orthodox tradition. As far as my own spin on things or design work, there is a lot of tradition behind each of the components," Sanderson said. "I don't make an attempt to stray too far from what is prescribed by tradition for these sorts of things." Sanderson said Orthodox churches can draw from different visual traditions, including Greek, Russian, Romanian, and Antiochian styles. "Greek-style work is more closely tied to the post-Byzantine tradition," he said, "while Russian-style iconostases often include Baroque and Rococo influences. Understanding the parish's tradition is one of the biggest influences on the design," he said. "Budget also matters, because more ornate styles generally require more carving." Holy Apostles' Bishop, Archbishop Daniel Doss, is scheduled to visit June 27th and 28th. Gresham said the visit will include a blessing of the iconostasis at the end of the liturgy, along with a luncheon. The visit will also mark Gresham's 10th anniversary as priest at Holy Apostles. Gresham said visitors are welcome at services and can check the parish website for its calendar. He said people who are unfamiliar with Orthodox worship should not feel intimidated. "A lot of people are kind of nervous to come to an Orthodox church, so let's demystify it," Gresham said. "Just come as yourself." Visitors may notice that Orthodox Christians stand often, make the sign of the cross, and bow during services. But Gresham said newcomers are welcome to simply observe and follow along as they are comfortable. Communion, however, is reserved for Orthodox Christians. For those curious about the faith or the parish, Gresham said, the invitation is simple. Our services are open to everyone. Gresham said, anybody is welcome to come. Visit holyapostlesbn.org for more information. Medicaid citizen bill to cut 10,000. Feds force end to immigrant eligibility by Peter Hancock, Capital News, Illinois. A bill that would soon head to Governor J.B. Pritzker's desk will officially remove an estimated 10,000 people from the state's Medicaid program, leaving them without any form of health coverage. That group is made up mainly of people who are not U.S. citizens, but who are in the country legally, according to the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. That includes refugees and asylum seekers, many of whom came to the United States with pre-existing health conditions. If they are enrolled, then they still have Medicaid up until October 1st, Edith Avila Hesser, ICIRR's Health Justice and Policy Director, said in an interview. This adds to the number of uninsured populations that we have here in the state of Illinois. And so, obviously, we will be working to educate this community about the resources that are available to them through community clinics like FQHCs, federally qualified health centers, and free and charitable clinics available throughout the state. Medicaid is a public health coverage program that is jointly funded by the federal government and the states. In 2025, Congress amended the federal eligibility rules for Medicaid with passage of H.R. 1, commonly known as President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. It removed eligibility for nearly all non-citizens except lawful permanent residents, Cuban and Haitian entrants, and migrants from certain Pacific Island nations known as the Compact of Free Association. In order to comply with that change in federal law, Illinois lawmakers included language in this year's annual Medicaid omnibus bill, Senate Bill 3365, removing most groups of non-citizens from eligibility under state law. They include, among others, immigrants who are honorably discharged U.S. veterans and their families, refugees and asylees, non-citizens identified as victims of trafficking, Amerasians from Vietnam, and American Indians born in Canada. We had to make that change to comply with H.R. 1 so that we didn't put our entire Medicaid program in jeopardy, Representative Anna Moeller, Democrat of Elgin, who chairs the House Working Group that wrote the omnibus bill, said in an interview. Although Illinois also provides health coverage outside the Medicaid system that is funded entirely with state dollars, the language in this year's bill specifically states that it shall not require any category of non-citizens or part thereof to be funded at state-only cost. For example, in 2020, Illinois launched a program to provide Medicaid-like coverage known as Health Benefits for Immigrant Seniors for non-citizens age 65 and over, regardless of their immigration status. The following year, it expanded that program with Health Benefits for Immigrant Adults, which covered adults age 42 to 64, regardless of immigration status. But the latter program was closed in 2025 amid budget and political pressure, and enrollment in the seniors program has been limited, while many of its enrollees have been shifted to other subsidized coverage programs. Illinois also participates in a limited program that provides health benefits to asylum applicants and victims of torture, trafficking, and other serious crimes. And to minimize the impact of the upcoming change in eligibility rules, immigrant rights advocates introduced legislation this year to expand that program. House Bill 4824, sponsored by Representative Dagmara Avalar, Democrat of Romeoville, and Senate Bill 3462, sponsored by Senator Graciela Guzman, Democrat of Chicago, would have extended coverage under that program for several additional categories of non-citizens who are in the country for various humanitarian reasons. But neither of those bills was ever assigned to a substantive committee. Mueller said budget pressures were the primary reason the bills were not considered this year, and she said that is not likely to change anytime soon. We're looking at enormous budget pressures next year because of the cuts in H.R. 1 to the Medicaid program, which is going to affect our overall budget, she said. Hopefully, at some point, we can get many of the provisions that were contained in H.R. 1 overturned federally. Fire districts get IDNR grants, by Matuz Janik, Bloomington. Three McLean County Fire Protection Districts are among 73 departments across Illinois receiving state-administered federal grant money intended to help rural and small fire departments pay for equipment and training. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources announced it awarded $495,000 through the Volunteer Fire Capacity Grant Program, which is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture Forest Service and passed through IDNR to local fire departments and fire training academies. In McLean County, Bellflower Fire Protection District received $10,000. Hudson Fire Protection District received $9,766. And Mount Hope Funks Grove Fire Protection District received $3,425. Together, the three awards total $23,191. The grant program reimburses 50% of eligible project costs up to $10,000 per department. According to a news release, the grants help departments buy equipment and pay for fire training, particularly in rural areas. IDNR Director Natalie Phelps Finney said in the release that the department was pleased to support fire protection districts that help protect lives and property in some of Illinois' underserved areas. These grants will fund critical equipment and training resources for rural communities throughout the state, Phelps Finney said. For Mount Hope Funks Grove Fire Protection District, the grant will help pay for Blue Card Command training, a hazard zone incident command training, and certification program used by fire departments around the country. Fire Chief Eric Folk said the department's total training project is about $6,850, with the grant covering half and the district covering the other half through its training budget. Folk said the training is designed for command staff and firefighters responding to incidents such as residential structure fires, light commercial fires, and larger commercial fires. He said the program is meant to improve command capability and standardize operations during emergency responses. The department's plans changed slightly after Blue Card recently released a lower-cost firefighter first responder version of the training, Folk said. Rather than sending every firefighter through the more expensive command-level course, Mount Hope Funks Grove plans to have command staff take the command-level training while other firefighters take the firefighter first responder version. The change allowed the department to stretch that grant money. Folk said he asked IDNR whether the department could offer some of the training to neighboring departments as long as the money stayed within the same type of training grant in the training approved in the grant. Now, Mount Hope Funks Grove expects to offer training opportunities to several nearby departments, including Allen Township Fire Protection District in Stanford, Dale Township Fire Protection District in rural Bloomington, and Randolph Fire Protection District in Hayworth. Folk said the goal is to get more firefighters trained in the same incident command system because those departments frequently work together on calls. We work together all the time, Folk said. We'll have the training and be better trained and equipped to handle these situations. Folks said training remains one of the broader challenges for volunteer and paid on-call departments. Many firefighters have full-time jobs, and finding time for required training can be difficult. We're all either volunteer or paid on-call, and almost everybody's got a job, Folks said. It's a national problem, he said, but we do what we can and try to make ends meet. Normal prepares streets for the Special Olympics Summer Games by Olivia Jacobs in Normal. The town of Normal is preparing for the Special Olympics annual Victory Dance celebration and announced road closures for the event. The Special Olympics 2026 Summer Games will start on Friday, June 12, and will continue through Sunday, June 14, throughout Bloomington Normal and on Illinois State University's campus. The following streets will be marked for a temporary ban on parking starting at 2 p.m. and closed to traffic at 4 p.m. Saturday, June 13th. North Street between Fell Avenue and Uptown Circle, Broadway and North Street intersection between the alley south of North Street and the post office. Drivers are encouraged to be cautious while traveling through the area. The roads are expected to reopen at 10 p.m. following the event. Friday event highlights include athlete competitions, health and wellness events, a young athletes program, fan and family experiences and signature moments, including the opening ceremony set for 8 p.m. at Hancock Stadium at ISU. Saturday highlights include athlete competitions, health and wellness events, as well as fan and interactive experiences, and will conclude with the victory dance from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Hancock Stadium. The event expects to see more than 15,000 people, including 3,450 athletes and unified partners, 1,250 coaches, 1,200 volunteers, and 10,000 family members and friends, according to a news release. The event is the largest sporting event for Special Olympics Illinois athletes. Sporting events include track and field, powerlifting, soccer, swimming, artistic and rhythmic gymnastics, and unified cornhole. For a full schedule of events and more information, visit soill.org/summer-games/. Clinton Blaze Injures Firefighter by Drew Zimmerman. Fire damaged a manufacturing building Tuesday evening in Clinton and sent one firefighter to the hospital with minor injuries, according to a social media post from the Clinton Fire Department. Firefighters were dispatched at 9:18 p.m. to 1600 East Main Street and discovered heavy fire conditions on the south side of the building, the post said. Crews had the fire under control within 20 minutes. No civilian injuries were reported, but one firefighter was transported to a hospital with a minor injury and has since been released. The department cleared the incident scene and was available by 2 a.m. the following morning. Although the cause of the fire is not believed to be suspicious, the incident is still being investigated by the Illinois State Fire Marshal's Office. Dixon woman dies after crash on I-39 near Minonk, Olivia Jacobs. A Dixon woman has been identified as a driver killed in a two-vehicle crash on Interstate 39 near Minonk. At 9:49 a.m. Wednesday, the Woodford County Coroner's Office was dispatched to southbound Interstate 39 at mile marker 22 near Minonk for a report of a two-vehicle crash. A driver of one of the vehicles, Lulahe Cosentino, 49, was pronounced dead at the scene at 11 a.m., the coroner's office said. It appears she was driving when her car was struck from behind, authorities said. The crash remains under investigation by the Woodford County Sheriff's Department and the coroner. Other individuals involved in the crash were transported to a nearby hospital by Life Flight and the local emergency medical services. An autopsy will be conducted along with toxicology studies, the coroner's office said. Pathologist testifies Bloomington man suffered several gunshot injuries in fatal altercation by Caitlin Klepek. Two gunshots that struck Jeffrey Rowery's head and back were fatal, but the man suffered six bullet wounds in total during a 2021 shooting in Bloomington, a forensic pathologist testified this week in McLean County Court. Dr. Scott Denton, the pathologist who performed Rowery's autopsy, testified Wednesday in the murder trial for Osmond McLaren Jr., who is accused of killing his former friend. McLaren, 29, of Bloomington, is charged with three counts of first-degree murder and two counts of unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon in the shooting death of the 30-year-old Bloomington man. Rowery was found shortly after 9 p.m., November 1, 2021, outside of his apartment in the 800 block of East Washington Street in Bloomington after neighbors reported hearing gunshots. Prosecutors have said McLaren shot Rowery in retaliation after Rowery and his former roommate kicked McLaren's girlfriend out of their shared apartment. On Wednesday, the former roommate testified that McLaren's girlfriend had caused trouble, which led to he and Rowery deciding to kick her out. He recalled McLaren being angry and asking him and Rowery, "You want competition with me?" Although the three men had been friends, Rowery had blocked McLaren on Snapchat prior to his death, the witness testified. About a month before the fatal shooting, the former roommate said McLaren, Rowery, and another man were involved in a heated argument at the courthouse. The third man testified Wednesday and identified himself as Rowery's cousin. During questioning Wednesday, First Assistant State Attorney Brad Rigdon said this witness had previously told detectives the argument ensued between him and McLaren after he jumped in to defend Rowery, when McLaren was talking disrespectfully to his cousin and Rowery was just sitting there, letting him talk to him all types of ways. But on the stand, he denied Rowery was the subject of the argument, testifying instead that the argument was actually about a different, unrelated person. During opening statements Monday, Rigdon told the jury the state will prove McLaren was the shooter by video surveillance, cell phone data, firearm evidence, and witness testimony, establishing both a motive leading up to the shooting and a suspect with McLaren's likeness. The prosecution said McLaren shot himself in the leg during the incident and then fled to Peoria for treatment in a getaway car. On Tuesday, two women testified that after they heard gunfire the night on November 4th, they saw two individuals running toward a gray or silver SUV that was parked in a gravel space in the alleyway behind the apartment building. The women said they were attempting to pull away when the two people ran in front of their car. They described the runners as tall and wearing ski masks and all black clothing. The women said they could not see much since it was dark, but they both were able to identify that one of them was limping as they ran. The limping person was trailing behind the other. Footage from surveillance video and a Peoria police officer's body-worn camera was shown Monday, placing McLaren at a Peoria hospital seeking treatment for a gunshot wound to his leg. He was dropped off at the hospital by a grayish silver SUV, surveillance video showed. McLaren told Peoria officers he had been shot somewhere in Peoria and an unknown person had picked him up and taken him to the hospital, the police footage showed. In another clip with a Bloomington officer's body-worn camera, McLaren accused the officer of harassing him, and he appeared agitated that the officer had confiscated his girlfriend's cell phone. Denton determined Rowery's cause of death was multiple gunshot wounds, but most notably two shots, one to the top of the head and one to the upper left back, were independently fatal and fired at a distant range. In total, Rowery had six bullet injuries, including all entrance and exit wounds, Denton said. The two fatal shots caused damage to Rowery's brain, skull, left lung, diaphragm, and kidney areas, resulting in hemorrhaging in his intestines.